My remarks this morning will be brief, more of a homily than a sermon. I want first to draw the somewhat disparate elements of this service into one piece, if possible, if I can. And secondly, read from and speak a little bit about E.E. Cummings, so that the little play we are about to enact will be somewhat more understandable. Somewhat. For the last several years, apparently, ESUC has been celebrating a solstice celebration every year, and we will do that again this year on December 21st, Friday evening. That service will acknowledge the common beauty and many common forms in the many winter solstice celebrations from across the world. But I want to try something a little bit different this December by focusing on the two most widely known of these wintertime rituals, Christmas and, more briefly, Hanukkah. Hanukkah is basically a celebration of political freedom. The Hanukkah story lauds the courage, brains, and chutzpah of a 2nd century BC Jewish family, the Maccabees, who managed to expel Greek imperial overlords from Judea and reestablish the Orthodox faith of their ancestors. Now, much has been written about these events, but today, this morning, suffice it to say that the Orthodox state reestablished by the Maccabees was hardly what we would call freedom in any democratic sense. Minority rights were in no way protected, nor was the right of individual conscience. These two elements, minority rights and the right of individual conscience, are the hallmarks of true democracy. Everything else is just majoritarianism. Although it is never secure and demands our constant vigilance, we are lucky here in America to enjoy a semblance of political freedom. However, political freedom is no guarantee that, in fact, we are free human beings. The blessings of political freedom merely offer us the opportunity to become free. To actually live as a free person requires courage and integrity and responsibility. It is this courage and responsibility that E.E. Cummings is concerned with. Christmas is the story of a miraculous occurrence, the incarnation, the idea that God, or shall we say, the creative forces of the universe, become incarnate in the body, heart, and mind of a little child. Indeed, in every child and every person, if one has the eyes and heart to see it. That, in essence, is the Christmas story. Now, over the next 2 weeks, Christians across the globe will share and act out the myth and ritual of Jesus' birth. The Christmas myth, like all myth, is basically a series of narrative metaphors, a poem, an imagery with which we make sense, perhaps, of the world. In this way, no myth can really be called false or untrue. It'd be like saying the plays of Shakespeare are false. You wouldn't really say that. But you might say they are effective, as the case may be, or ineffective. They don't stir you. Ritual is the acting out of myth so that we know it, or rather experience the myth with our whole bodies and central nervous systems and not just our heads. When it works, that is when it's effective, the use of myth in this way can engender intuition, maybe even the experience, the epiphany of genuine wholeness or connection to the creative forces within, the divine inner voice, the still small voice. This experience, this insight, according to E.E. Cummings, that's real freedom. And as I've said, it's no mere head trip. Rather, it's the total psychic and physical experience of integration with others and paradoxically within one's deepest self. There may even be, in the words of William Wordsworth, one of Cumming's major influences, intimations of immortality. Another dimension of these moments of deep insight is the sensation of total aesthetic synthesis, what the French poet Charles Baudelaire called synesthesia. Usually this is experienced as a blending of the senses, seeing lights or colors when a sound is heard, or hearing music at the sight of something beautiful, heart-rending or soul-stirring. As the Nobel laureate Bob Dylan wrote, and as our interim music director Eric just sang for us, we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. But there's a problem. Religious ritual, by use of myth and metaphor, is designed to open us up to these integrative insights, sometimes even to intimations of immortality. But for many Unitarian Universalists and for many people in the modern world, the forms of religious myth and ritual that they grew up with have become, for them, rigid and lifeless, such that they no longer serve as expressive vehicles for bringing about these kinds of deep connecting experiences that I'm talking about. The Christmas story for some of these folks, or the Hanukkah story for that matter, is not alive for them. They don't connect to any of it. So, what do we do in that case? Or rather, what do I do, charged as I am with nurturing the spiritual life of our community and charged also with preaching three times a month, preaching something meaningful, something one hopes that signifies. Great preaching, great oratory of any kind, including theater, connects the listener with others, reminds us of our wholeness. Somehow I'm supposed to do that, at least occasionally. But how to do it? How to help us collectively feel our collective hearts when we don't share the same symbols, or in the case of some, consider the symbols bogus to begin with? What then? Is the only way people can feel part of something bigger than themselves nowadays is to go join a gang or a political rally or a revolutionary cell? Do we just bag the whole notion of Sunday services as having any kind of worshipful and meaningful purpose? I do not think so. I think instead you youth need to take the images around that do affect us and work with them or rework them. If some of the traditional metaphors don't always work for us, then how about acting out some of our own? E.E. Cummings is one of our own. Son of a prominent Unitarian minister in Boston, his poetry speaks from a place that many of us, I suspect, can resonate with. Anyway, let's give it a whirl and see. Our drama, Santa Claus, was first published in 1946. Our production this morning is a slightly shortened version. The cuts made by Cummings himself when delivering the Charles Eliot Norton lectures at Harvard University in 1953. Before we go to the play itself, however, I'd like to read a few short passages from the same lecture, or, as the poet put it, non-lecture series. Wrote Cummings. So far as I am concerned, poetry and every other art was and is and forever will be a strictly and distinctly a question of individuality. If poetry were anything like dropping an atomic bomb that anyone did, anyone could become a poet merely by doing the necessary anything, whatever that might be or might not entail. But as it happens, poetry is being, not doing. If you wish to follow, even at a distance, the poet's calling, you've got to come out of the measurable doing universe and into the immeasurable house of being. Art is a mystery. A mystery is something immeasurable. Insofar as every child and woman and man may be immeasurable, art is the mystery of every man and woman and child. Insofar as a human being is an artist, skies and mountains and oceans and thunderbolts and butterflies are immeasurable. And art is every mystery of nature. The artist does not live in some geographical abstraction, superimposed on a part of his beautiful earth by the non-imagination of unanimals and dedicated to the proposition that massacre is a social virtue because murder is an individual vice. Nor does the artist live in some self-styled world, nor does he live in some so-called universe, nor does he live in any number of worlds or any number of universes. As for the few trifling delusions like the past, present, and future, or quote, mankind, unquote, they may be big enough for a couple of billion super mechanized submorons, but they are much too small for one human being. Every artist's strictly illimitable country is him or herself. An artist that plays that country false has committed suicide. And even a good lawyer cannot kill the dead. But a human being who's true to himself or herself, whoever that may be, is immortal. And all the atomic bombs of all the anti-artists in space-time will never civilize immortality. Twenty-four years ago, I had the occasion to be in Cambridge, Massachusetts, visiting the Harvard Andover Library at the Harvard Divinity School. It was October 15th, you know, New England's just so beautiful. The leaves were in the midst of their annual autumn display. And I took an hour or so to make kind of a pilgrimage, walking around the corner through the beautiful old neighborhood from the library to Irving Street and E.E. Cummings' childhood home on what would have been his 100th birthday. It's a stately home, a mansion, really. His dad was a professor at Harvard University. Teachers nowadays, for some reason, if they can get tenure, don't make the fine salaries they did 120 years ago. In any case, E.E. Cummings' father, Edward Cummings, left his Harvard professorship when offered the pulpit of Boston South Congregational, really Unitarian Church. It's interesting, the relative prestige of those positions 125 years later. Who do you think would leave a tenured professorship at Harvard to take on the always touch and go politically life of a pastor? Six non-lectures series, Cummings talks about his childhood. Next door lived William James, the philosopher. And across the street lived another philosopher, Josiah Royce. And there were several other famous scholars in the neighborhood, too. He writes that by the time he was in his 30s or 40s, people were regularly calling him a genius, to which he would always reply, "Anyone would have been a genius who grew up in my neighborhood." Although his father was a prominent Unitarian minister, there's not much written about him beyond what I've already shared and three quotes. He's noted for having once said what many a minister has thought when, on one balmy spring day, he looked out at the congregation and explained, "I don't know why any of you would be in church on a beautiful day like today." A memory told by his poet son was of his dad, the preacher, booming out in his most sonorous voice, "The kingdom of heaven is no spiritual roof garden. It's inside you." And Cummings wrote of him that he gave me Plato's myth of the cave with my mother's milk. And now I see that our cast is ready, so here we begin our little allegory in blank verse, whose characters are death, Santa Claus, mob, child, and woman.
Something wrong, brother?
Yes.
Sick?
Sick at heart.
What seems to be the trouble? Come, speak out.
I have so much to give, and nobody will take.
My problem is also one of distribution, only it happens to be the other way around.
Emanating friendliness, Death explains that he and Santa Claus are living in a world so blurred that its inhabitants are one another. A world so false, so trivial, so unso, that phantoms are solid by comparison.
This is a world of salesmanship,
he continues, and you are so unlucky as to be gifted with understanding, the only thing which simply cannot be sold. What you need to do is become a scientist, or in plain English, a knowledge salesman, since
in this empty, ununderstanding world, anyone can sell knowledge. Everybody wants knowledge, and there's no price people won't pay to get it.
But, objects Santa Claus, it appears that
I have no knowledge, only understanding.
Forget your understanding for a while. And as for knowledge, why, don't let that worry you. Once people hear the magic name of science, you can sell people anything except understanding.
Yes.
Anything at all.
You mean provided?
Provided nothing.
You don't mean to tell me I can sell people something that didn't exist.
Why not? You don't suppose people exist, do you?
Don't people exist?
People? I'll say they don't. I wish to heaven they did exist. In that case, I shouldn't be the skeleton I am. No, this science game, this knowledge racket, infinity's your limit. But remember, the less something exists, the more people want it.
I can't seem to think of anything that doesn't exist. Perhaps you can help me.
How about a wheel mine?
A wheel mine?
Surely a wheel mine doesn't exist and never will, and surely never has existed.
A wheel mine? But that's perfectly fantastic.
Why say fantastic when you can mean scientific? Well, I'll be strolling. So long, Mr. Scientist.
Next, we behold Santa Claus, now loudly proclaiming himself a scientist, in the act of selling shares of Wheelmine stock to a mob, whose rampant skepticism rapidly turns to wild enthusiasm.
Step right up, folks. Come this way. Get your shares right here. There you go.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Anybody else? There you go. Just a moment, friends. It never shall be said that science favored or slighted anyone. Remember, science is no mere individual. Individuals are, after all, nothing but human beings, and human beings are corruptible. For, as you doubtless know, to err is human. Think, only think, for untold centuries this earth was overrun by human beings. Think, it was not so many years ago that individuals could be found among us. Oh, those dark ages, what a darkness, friends. But now that hideous darkness turns to light. The flame of science blazes far and wide, science impartial and omnipotent. Before those superhuman radiance, all dark pre-scientific instincts vanish. Think, just think. At last the monster, man, is freed of his obscene humanity. While men were merely men and nothing more, what was equality? A word, a dream? Men never could be equal. But why? Because equality is the attribute of supermen, like you and you and you. And therefore, super ladies and super gentlemen, when the impartial ear of science hears your superhuman voices crying, "Gimme," science responds in its omnipotence, "Let there be enough wheel mine stock for all." Come this way.
As scene three opens, Santa Claus, now in terror of his life, comes running to death, crying, There's been a terrible accident in the wheel mine. And as a consequence, the enthusiastic mob now wants to lynch him. Death, secretly delighted, pooh-poos the whole matter and coolly assures his victim that a wheel mine is something perfectly non-existent.
Oh? Then tell me, how can it maim? How can it mutilate? How can it turn mere people into monsters? Answer me, how?
My friend, you've forgotten something. Namely, that people, like wheel mines, don't exist. Two negatives, you know, make an affirmative. Now, if I may be allowed to analyze...
Do you want to die?
I? Die? How could death die?
Death?
You didn't know.
I'm going mad. You, tell me, whatever you are, death or the devil, tell me, how can I prove I'm not to blame for the damage caused by an accident, which never happened, to people who are non-existent?
You can't.
My God, what am I going to do then?
Do? Why, my dear fellow, it looks to me as if you'll have to prove that you yourself don't exist.
But that's absurd.
And tragic. Yet, a fact. So, make it snappy, Mr. Santa Claus.
Facing the furious mob, Santa Claus at first denies he is a scientist and asserts that wheel mines don't exist, but all in vain.
Down with science, you science!
Wait, ladies and gentlemen, if you have all been deceived by some imposter, so have I. If you have all been tricked and ruined, so have I. I say it and you feel it in your hearts. We are all of us no longer glad and whole. We have all of us sold our spirits unto death. We are all of us the sick parts of a sick thing. We have all of us lost our living honesty, and so we are all of us not anymore ourselves. Who can tell truth from falsehood anymore? I say it, and you feel it in your hearts. No man or woman on this big, small earth, how should our sages miss the mark of life and our most skillful players lose the game? Your hearts will tell you, as my heart has told me, because all know and no one understands. Oh, we are so full of knowing that we are empty. Empty of understanding, but by that emptiness, I swear to you, and if I lie, ladies and gentlemen, hang me a little higher than the sky. All men and every woman may be wrong, but nobody who lives can fool a child. Now, I'll abide by the verdict of that little girl's over there, the one with the yellow hair and blue eyes. I'll simply ask her who I am, and whoever she says I am. Fair enough?
That's fair. You bet you. We believe in God.
Okay. Silence. Child, don't be afraid. Who am I?
You are Santa Claus.
Santa Claus?
Then, ladies and gentlemen, I don't exist. And since I don't exist, I'm not guilty. And since I'm not guilty, I'm innocent. Goodbye, and next time, look before you leap.
When next we see our unhero, he is wondering if the little girl who identified him correctly as Santa Claus could perhaps be his own lost child. Our villain now appears, emanating cordiality, and in return for the good advice which saved his almost victim's life, asks a favor.
I've got a heavy date with a swell Jane up the street a little way, but something tells me she prefers plump fellows. Will you give me your fat in exchange for my skeleton?
With all the pleasure in the world, old-timer, and I'll throw in a wheel mine just for luck.
No wheel mines, thank you.
They undress and exchange costumes, then off goes Death as Santa Claus, and in comes Child. Although the real Santa Claus is now completely disguised as Death, she immediately recognizes him, and before she dances away, he understands not only that he is her father, but that she, like himself, is looking for somebody very beautiful and very sad who has lost them both. Scene 5 follows.
Knowledge has taken love out of the world, and all the world is empty, empty, empty. For men are not men in all the world anymore. For a man who cannot love is not a man. And only a woman in love can be a woman. And from their love alone comes joy. Joy. Knowledge has taken love out of the world. And all the world is joyless, joyless, joyless. Come, Death, for I have lost my joy, and I have lost my love, and I've lost myself. You have wanted me, now take me.
Now and forever.
How fortunate is dying, since I seem to hear his voice again.
Death, 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 death.
Could the world be any emptier?
Don't be afraid.
O voice of him I loved more than life, protect me from this deathless lifelessness.
Yay! Yay! Dad! Dad! Hooray! He'll never sell another wheel of mine again. Never!
Yes, the world could be emptier.
Now?
No, never. I had remembered love, but who am I? Thanks, Death, for making love remember me. Joy, yes, yes. My life, my love, my soul, myself. Not yours, Death.
No.
Hours.
So ends our little allegory and this morning's lesson. A double lesson, outwardly affirming that whereas a world or an empire, a culture, a mob rises only to fall, the human spirit descends to ascend. The inward lesson that the road to individuation, to heaven, begins with our personal confrontation with death has been said by poets of all ages. But our Unitarian poet, Mr. Cummings, goes a little further. It is the outward lesson, simple and yet so elusive, that all groups, gangs, collectivities, no matter how apparently disparate, are fundamentally alike. That what makes the world go round is not the trivial difference between a Bellevue and a Rainier Beach, but the immeasurable difference between either and individuality. I have found, Cummings writes, authentic individuals in the most varied environments conceivable. And what then is an authentic individual, according to E.E. Cummings?
I am someone who proudly and humbly affirms that love is the mystery of mysteries.
And that nothing measurable matters a very good goddamn.
That an artist, a man, a failure, is no mere whenfully accreting mechanism, but a givingly eternal complexity.
Neither some soulless and heartless ultra-predatory infra-animal,
nor any ununderstandingly knowing and believing and thinking automaton,
but a naturally and miraculously whole human being.
A feelingly illimitable individual.
whose only happiness is to
transcend himself,
whose every agony is to grow.
Amen.
In the words of the 19th century Scottish biologist, writer, and lecturer Henry Drummond, "Say to thyself, is there any good thing that I can do or any kindness that I can show to any human being? Then let me do it now, for I may not pass this way again."